Two speakers from PwC. We have Michelle Finlay. Michelle is a qualified actuary with 20 years' experience in the financial service industry, predominantly in the savings and retirement markets, covering a wide variety of investment, pre-retirement and in-retirement income solutions. She worked for a number of corporate life insurance and reinsurance companies, including AXA, Aviva, RGA UK, and more recently MetLife Europe. Her experience spans globally across Australia, the UK and various European marketplaces. She has extensive experience in leading and delivering new products and capability to the market, including areas of product design, pricing and implementation. And Catherine Nance, advisor and actuary of the financial service industry with specialist skills in superannuation, investment and retirement incomes. Areas of expertise include strategic consulting on superannuation benefits, insurance, defined benefit conversions, mergers and due diligence, ageing Australia policy issues and product development, valuation of employee benefits, investment consulting, asset liability studies, unit pricing and credit rate policies and rectifications. And involved with many government and industry superannuation funds, institutional investors, including insurance funds and universities. Active member in the Institute of Actuaries Superannuation Policy Group, task force responding to Henry Tax Review and International Financial Reporting Standards Committee, and on various boards including Director of Community CPS Australia Limited, Director and Chair of Audit Committee Western Australia Treasury Corporation, Director of the Government Employee Superannuation Fund of WA. So we have some very well-qualified people speaking. Just a reminder, we'll have the presentation first, then we'll take questions, discussion. You'll need, when you do that, to speak into the microphone and give your name, and I'll hand it over to our speakers.
Welcome everyone. Today Cathy and I are going to be looking at Australia's ageing population and what we're going to be looking at that in the context of what that means for the wealth management industry. We surveyed a number of product manufacturers, superannuation funds and financial planners to get their views and their thoughts in five key areas around consumer awareness, education, the advice model, product innovation, consumer bases and regulatory change. So what I'll be presenting in the first part of today's presentation is I'll be looking back at the issues that they identified, the problems and some suggestions. Cathy then will have a look at other observations that have arisen through our discussions. So to start, where are we currently? It's projected that almost one in five Australians will be aged 65 and over within the next 20 years. We're still retirees today still have modest balances. There's a large dependency on the age pension, and retirees are faced with increasing uncertainty, not only around financial markets, but also funding for aged care and with grappling with how long they're actually going to live. In Australia to date, we also have a limited range of products that protect against longevity risk. And there's a lot of focus on reducing costs and driving through efficiencies in our retirement system. And there's a lot of reform that's currently happening. So with all of this in mind, and as our landscape changes, how can Australia's wealth management industry prepare itself to act in the best interests of the ageing population? To start, we wanted to get a sense of how well retirees actually understand the risks and challenges that they face in retirement. It was considered that retirees do have a good understanding that at some point their money is going to run out. But we are asking retirees to plan beyond a period that they can actually comprehend. Also, with regards to the investment markets, retirees have a good sense that the markets rise and fall, and they've lived through the, you know, global financial crisis, understand that that's going to have an impact on their savings. But the sequence of return risk is still far from being fully understood. So we've heard this morning that as a wealth management industry, we don't do a particularly good job at educating or raising the awareness of consumers around their risks and challenges that they face. Advertisements, for example, have a limited airtime and can often add to the confusion. particularly where there's different views and views are polarised across the industry. And a good example of that, and we've heard that here at the conference over the last couple of days, is the debate around equities and bond exposure. We also do consumers an injustice by talking about averages. So we look at average returns. Yet average returns don't help illustrate or demonstrate the sequence of return risks. And we also have a tendency to oversimplify our retirees and lump them in one bucket. And we've also heard from Melanie Evans this morning that lumping people into a bucket and a one-size-fits-all solution isn't always the most appropriate. We need to be taking into account the retirees' unique individual circumstances. So as an industry, we can be build better tools, start to talk in different metrics, start to look at outcomes, start to look at different scenarios, and actually start to focus on individual circumstances. And start to plan, give a holistic a view across the retiree's life cycle. So there are examples of what companies are doing at the moment around, different tools where they're engaging with the customer, starting to take the customer on a journey. And we just see this as being something that will continue into the future. In terms of the advice model, we asked if it's time for a change. The accessibility to advice, that was raised as a concern, and it was felt that FOFA is likely to further impact on the accessibility and the affordability of that advice. So retirees who seek advice, it was felt that they do value that advice, but also advice comes as a choice. It is a choice. But who's going to service those retirees with their small balances and their assets as they run down? Advisors also tend to focus on providing advice in areas where they can continue to provide that advice. So I guess what I'm trying to say is that they don't favour the packaged or the implemented solutions such as the life cycle funds. However, bespoke solutions do come at a cost. So looking forward, it was felt that there is a need for scaled advice, for a triage or tier approach to the advice model, a systemised approach, a lower cost offering, so that it's affordable to reach the mass market. And there's also a need for realistic and client-focused communication, so for advisors to build that trusted and ongoing relationship as the retiree starts to take that journey through their retirement. So moving on, having a look at product innovation, do we actually need more? Currently at the moment, there's a low take-up of longevity risk protection products. We have a high dependency on the age pension. We've got retirees with small balances. They don't have the money to invest in retail products or longevity products, essentially. And they may want to use their super assets to pay off their debts in retirement. Then we also have behavioural obstacles to overcome. And on the supply side, it was felt that there's no real impediments to product development other than for your deferred lifetime annuities, but perhaps that it's the companies who have reduced or lost their appetite for taking on that risk. Looking forward, it was felt that sometimes, again, we overcomplicate things, adding bells and whistles and adding complexity to products also adds costs and can reduce the return to the customer. It was felt that there is no silver bullet with regards to, future product development or innovation. The themes in terms of future development was around helping to manage and control risks better within the product and moving away from that strategic asset allocation, whether you're invested in a 60-40 fund or a 70-30 fund, for example. And it was also felt that there is a need for product solutions to fund for aged care. There was also some discussion around the government being the most efficient insurer for longevity risk. So just to finish, we We wanted to understand how well customer bases are currently understood. It was felt that the banks, the insurance companies, the superannuation funds do understand the changing needs of the retirees at a macro level, but perhaps their behavioural and their predictive modelling is still quite in its infancy and not as sophisticated as, say, Google and Apple. So with all this change, with big data around the corner, banks are starting to build that single view of their customer that will help them to, tailor retirement solutions to the individuals and continue to have those conversations with retirees throughout their life cycle. And regulation, there is a lot of it at the moment, and it was unanimous that this is, in fact, delaying or diverting attention to, true product innovation. Companies only have so much money to go around, so a lot of the budget is currently being spent on mandatory or regulatory change. So whilst it might be adding cost to the business, it was also felt that those costs needed to be borne, and it was essential to drive out the inefficiencies in the super system. Regulatory change was also viewed to be an opportunity for companies to start to look at how they can relook at their business models. So on that note, I'll hand over to Cathy.
Thanks, Michelle. Hello, everyone. I'm going to pull together just some observations, really our observations from having worked through the survey in terms of knowing where the market is, how retirement is currently funded, and then what we think might sort of be happening from now on. So if we start with the size of the market, we know that we've got roughly 3 million people aged over 65, and that's going to more than double over the next 40 years. And we also know that there's about $1 trillion in assets sitting in super balances for over 50s. About two-thirds of that is in super funds and about one-third is in self-managed super funds. So we can see the size of the market in terms of numbers and dollars. When we look at how retirement is funded, I think sometimes when people are calling for sort of needs for lots of annuity products and things like that, we do probably forget just exactly where all the funding is now, because we do have a very high reliance on the age pension, which means that a lot of people are already getting a lifetime annuity. In fact, 80% are already getting a lifetime annuity through the government. And that's only forecast through the intergenerational reports and Treasury modelling to drop down to 75%, even in 40 years' time under a mature SG market. Now, what changes is the number of people on the full pension. So that's going to reduce. And obviously with the increase from SG going to 9 to 12, that will also continue to reduce that reliance on the full age pension. But it doesn't really reduce the number of people that will be on an age pension. So it is important to remember that the bulk of the people, 75-80%, already have a life annuity, and they will already and into the future be receiving an age pension. Dependency typically grows from around about half your retirement income at the start of retirement to the majority of it by the end of retirement, 50% up to 85%. Home ownership is another thing that's really important. We do have, as you all know, a very high level of home ownership in Australia. In fact, home is our dominant source of wealth in retirement. It is more than super. The average retirement payment we know is fairly limited now, $200 for men, $110 for women. And again, the increase in SG, that might increase that 30%, but we're really only talking about 200 going to 260. We're not talking these mega sums of money. It's a very limited group of the market that has the really large pools of savings. The median worker is not going to be getting much more than that 200 to 300 mark, even with the increase in SG. The number of retirees who use all or part of their super to pay off mortgages and debt, recent retirees, a third. And this is something we have to bear in mind too, that the rise of home equity loans has meant that a lot of people end up on retirement and the first thing they need to do is pay off their debt. So the need for lump sums, even people if they're leaving with $200,000, $250,000, the first port of call for some of that money will be actually to distinguish their debt they're carrying on their home. Tax concessions for super, in my view, they're only going down. We only have to look at the budget announcements to say that the message I'm getting from the government is they're saying we're putting a really clear box around super savings and it ain't going to be a big box. So those higher income people, it's going to become more and more and more limited how much of your savings will actually be allowed to be in the super tax concessional space versus pushed out of the tax concessional space. And I think that that's also relevant when we're thinking about super product as opposed to product more broadly. So the keys from that is that the majority of retirees, 70 to 80% of retirees, will receive a life annuity in the future through the age pension. They will have limited super savings and they will have significant home wealth as compared to super savings. 20% of retirees will become increasingly reliant, I think, on product outside of super to meet their product savings type needs. In terms of advice, we are moving to a tiered, triaged advice model for financial advice, which is very similar to the same move in the health sector. So what we're doing is we're really saying that we're trying to push the majority of people up to get their needs met from the lower cost options. And you can see this in health where we're bringing in more places where, you know, nurses are the first port of call and you can get 80% of your complaints met and needs met through nursing staff, and then you only go to doctors or specialists for the more complex things. And it's going to be the same in financial advice. Basic financial literacy and scaled advice will be designed to meet the majority of people's needs, and then only more complex needs will go into the financial planning for complex advice. 20 to 40% of adults seek advice now. The average cost of advice is probably about $3,000, and the surveys generally show that people don't want to pay much more than $500 for advice. So the bulk of the needs do have to get met up in that scaled sector. Some of the developments in this area is that if you haven't had a look through the ASIC site at the National Financial Literacy Program they're developing, it is really worthwhile looking at, because they're looking at providing significant generic scaled advice, interactive decision trees, tools. They've got the Money Smart calculators, but they're really modelling this on a UK model that's been rolled out, where they see that they can meet a lot of people's needs for good independent generic advice through the ASIC Financial Literacy Program, which incorporates this type of thing. So there's a lot happening up in those, and education and things like that. They're about to roll out a curriculum for education in terms of financial literacy. We know we have a low level of literacy in this country. The ANZ study is a sort of preeminent study, and it shows that, I think, lower income earners, people without post-secondary education, females, are some of the groups that are the young, very disadvantaged in terms of financial literacy. UK studies have shown that only 25% of adults have low financial literacy, so we know that we have to build those areas. In terms of complex advice, I don't think that FOFA, which is, with its increased transparency, and this was a view coming out of our surveys as well, is going to increase demand for complex advice. It will make the fees and everything more transparent, but it won't necessarily increase demand, because people are just not going to pay, the majority of people are not going to pay what it costs to provide that advice. And that leaves that middle area as being where most retirees' needs will have to be met, and it will be very technology-driven, segmented, predictive advice with tailored products combined with intelligent defaults. We do know that with our scaled advice, it has to handle some of the risks better than it does now. One of the things coming out of the survey is that I know there's a need for simplicity, but we're oversimplifying some important things too much. Like, we do have to better handle life expectancy. We can't talk about 87, 84 being average expectancy. That's without even known mortality improvements. History has shown we only ever underestimate mortality improvements. We should be talking 90, 86, but still that's only an average. And then if we're looking at one in five, it's 97, 94, so that's plus 30 years. We're not really covering that off in our scaled advice at the moment, and we need to get better at that. The other area is the sequence of investment returns risk. This is just a simple graph, and there's plenty of these around to show, like, you can start with the same account balance, $500,000 at age 65. You can get the same average return. So think of all the ads that says, you know, our average return over 10 years has been 8% per annum or whatever. And 20 years' time, you can either end up with around about $300,000 or nil, depending on whether you had a poor start to those average returns or a good start. In other words, whether you had lower returns up early, higher returns at the back end, or higher returns up early and lower returns at the back end. So simply by a dependency of the time at which you retire and volatility in those markets, you can have a vastly different outcome. And when scaled advice is often predicted, even the money smart, as good as it is, it does rely on an average return per annum. And unfortunately, there is no such thing. Or if it is, it's cash, and it's definitely not what people are modelling. So our tools need to get smarter about handling those types of risks. In terms of product design type issues, yes, we have a limited product range currently. It's a little bit crowded by the extent to which people are on age pension, and also reform, which has sapped up the sort of product development energy a little bit and the capital costs. There's been some developments, like we do have annuities now. We have term annuities. We have life, even though quite limited take-up. We have deposits, of course, term deposits have been a really big thing in the last few years because of the rates. New South Wales has introduced a new bond they're hoping to sell in the retail world to retirees. So there's been a little bit of development. What's probably missing is investment income options with hard, soft guarantees, things that may cope a little bit better with that sequence of return risks. Maybe it's as simple as saying that defaults in retirement shouldn't be 70-30 mixes, but maybe they need to be something more like a 50-50 type mix. We do have to remember, though, that 10-30-60 rule, that 10% of your retirement income has come from the contributions you made whilst you're active, 30% from the accumulation of earnings whilst you're active, and 60% from earnings whilst you were retired, because that's when they got the bulk of the money. So if we say that everyone should be really conservative, or if we say that there should be lots of guaranteed products and guarantees costs, so you're actually just taking the return, you are significantly reducing the available income you'll have in retirement. The other thing to remember is super is just one component of wealth. In housing wealth, super represents 16% of wealth, and housing represents 55% of wealth. So when we're talking about super, we can't do it in isolation of saying that most people have got significant property assets that sit alongside that super, whether it's in equities or fixed interest. Life annuities will have a limited role to play. I personally think quite limited because of their inflexibility, just some indicative pricing, 50,000 lump sum buys, $50 a week. So you've got to be prepared to put a lot of capital away to get a sort of anything like an income corresponding to modest or comfortable. Deferred life annuities, I think, will have a greater role to play as an option. Or as an intelligent default. They're currently blocked by legislation, so we do need to remove those blocks because they are a valuable product. I don't think they should be compulsory, but I do think that there's a valuable role that they play. And indicative pricing, again, 15,000 lump sum up front on deferral, 65 would get you $50 per week at 85. You can start to get some reasonable sort of income levels that support an age, basic age pension by using deferred life annuities. And if we look at an example, this is from Money Smarts. It's got no sequence of risk issues in here. And it's what it's saying is it's a female, 150,000. So let's say they had 200,000, spent 50 paying off their mortgage as homeowner. What would they be looking at if they, with their money, if they want to take something like in the order about 25,000, a bit over 25,000, you can see the modest and comfortable marks broadly up there on the screen, the red dots. You can see that money's going to run out basically at average expectancy at the moment, which is 85. And from then on, they would be on the age pension, which is about 19,000. Now, that actually might work for a lot of people because it is true to say for a lot of people, the needs do reduce. So that's why I don't think that annuities should ever be compulsory, because that actual model may work for a lot of people. But if you want to spread it out, then all the deferred annuity is, it just takes a little bit from you as you go along and puts a little bit more in your later years, so you end up with a bit less than 25,000. You pay a couple of thousand a year up front, and you can replace that level of savings then and keep your income fairly smooth into sort of older age, and this maps it out up until about 95. The other option is that something that I've been a believer in some time is I don't believe that product or people actually handle unknown periods of time very well. And I think one other option is to back end the age pension You can do it on a compulsory basis or a voluntary basis, and I've always thought that it would be very difficult to do it on a compulsory basis, in other words, by forcing people to spend all their savings first. But it's quite easy to do it on a voluntary basis by allowing concepts such as a deferred age pension, which is you can defer your entitlement and you get a higher pension later. And, of course, if you do that, you're just simply pushing that age pension component out higher later. And so then you can focus your savings and your work efforts on those earlier periods of time, knowing what pension you'll get later will suddenly start to be a bit more between modest and comfortable. So I think they're all options that we need to have available to us in order for people to create what will best suit their needs. So basically, it's that thing about known periods of time. There's more capacity for product to handle known periods of time, term annuities, investment guarantee type products, soft, hard guarantees. And it is true to say, I think, that the government does cope better with a very long longevity period of time. I also think individuals don't cope as well as they get older. Like, even things like buying product, filling out forms becomes really quite difficult. And I think the elderly, the real elderly, get very exposed to being taken for a ride at that time. So product design issues, the demand for super is limited for some time because of the balances, age pension, but it's growing. Low to middle income earners do have a life annuity. No one product's ever going to be the answer. And for that reason, compulsion's not the answer. It will be a mix. Michael Sherris's group at Uni New South Wales is doing really good work, I think, on different mixes of product as part of their longevity research. There is a role for annuities, so I think the government should remove the block. Demand might be limited for a little while, but no one's going to spend money on product development whilst the legislation blocks that product. So we do have to remove the blocks. We do need to keep super in perspective as one component. And I do think that non-super product is likely to increase, particularly for higher income earners. So the old life bond, tax-paid bond, may come back into forte for people. The role of government, there is a burden of ageing that's coming through in all the intergenerational reports, and S&P did a report that showed that the government would move from AAA to speculative rating by 2040 if they don't make any changes. So I think that it's probably not likely that the government's going to want to extend concessions or exemptions because of that burden already that they're facing. It's easy for them to remove the blocks, issue more long-dated bonds that doesn't cost, and that would help product development. I think if we're serious about annuities, we have to talk about a national annuity protection scheme. I do believe that gone are the days when we can say an insurer will never fail. And if we're really serious about people buying 30, 40-year product, there should be some insurance scheme. The UK has it. It can be an unfunded scheme. It can be a bit like SISPART 23A. Where it's a levy if something happens. Yes, there's moral hazard, but basically we've got SISPART 23A. That seems to have worked. It hasn't created a lot of super funds that have gone out there and behaved ridiculously thinking that everything will be okay. So there is a moral hazard risk, but I think the benefits of having some sort of protection scheme would outweigh it. And finally, I think most state and Commonwealth governments now have what they call regulatory reform groups, where they're trying to reduce legislation, reduce regulation, and you've got to prove that, you know, it's the cost benefits of added regulation. And every time we hear yet more announcements like the budget announcement, changing tax concessions, changing concessional tax contributions, I just think, where is the cost benefit of that? You know, super just seems to have fallen out through this loop that there's no rigour around, is it really worth it to make yet more change? So I think bring in the red tape efficiency police. So they're our final messages, basically, under the areas, both from the survey and also from our own observations. So consumer awareness, yes, there's a literacy gap, but there's a lot happening, particularly from ASIC, to help fill it. Advice is oversimplified at the moment in terms of longevity and investment risks. We've got to find better and cleverer ways of doing it. Age pension will be a key part of retirement income for most people for as long as we can really look forward, and we have to take that into account. Future advice, I think, remains fairly limited for complex, but scaled advice is going to be the big winner, and how we do it and how cleverly we do it. Future for product, it's growing, but it's a little bit crowded out at the moment. But I think there'll be increasing demand outside of super. From the government's point, we need to remove the DOLA box. We've got to start talking about some sort of annuity protection scheme, and we've got to reduce change. So I'll just leave it on that note for any questions.
Okay, thank you very much. Okay, so we'll open it up for questions. Please state your name and speak into the microphone, or comments or discussions. There's a lot of issues being covered. I'm sure there's a lot of people wanting to make some comments or ask some questions. Don't rush the microphone. Yeah, Ken.
Ken Lockery. Thanks, Michelle and Cathy. I found some interesting challenges there. I guess I would, I'm not sure if this is a question or a comment, but I'm interested in whether or not there's much in the way of research going on in two particular areas. One, you mentioned the issue of people having lower needs once they get older. And obviously there's the health and aged care type need at that end of the process, albeit largely government funded. And I wonder if there's been much research in the degree to which people's spending falls off in those later years. I have a very elderly mother who really survives quite nicely on an age pension with her government subsidies or whatever in that context. And I just think this question... like you, Cathy, I'm not a fan of compulsory annuities, and I just wonder if the need sits there if you start to look at the way people's needs fall off. And in fact, if there's a point at which the age pension becomes more than enough. We saw, for those who were in the session with the man from UBank, enormous analysis of spending habits, and I wondered if you could actually take all that by aged people and actually see how their spending habits change as they get older. The other one is this problem of sequence of returns in retirement, because I think it is true that trying to guarantee investment returns is an expensive exercise, and what research has been done in ways of managing that. I have seen some suggestions about, you know, having enough years of drawdown in cash, and what that's really doing is changing your asset allocation. Actually, as the market falls, getting a more aggressive asset allocation on the expectation that eventually the market will come back. So I was wondering, they seem to me two critical areas of research that we throw up on the graphs and we say, well, maybe people don't need as much money, or there's this problem with sequence of returns. And I wonder what work, if any, is being done in those areas.
Okay, well, just a couple. So, first of all, spending patterns on retirees. There's been little bits of research done on it, but not a lot. And the ASFA standard that does look at modest, comfortable, is now doing it at 70 and at 90. And the 90 age 90 level is a couple of thousand, from memory, lower than the age 70 level. So, particularly at the sort of comfortable level. So they're seeing that there is a bit of a decline. I think most of it is more anecdotal, like your own, that that people are more active in the earlier phases, touring and travelling and things like that, and less active at the later stages. And we probably all have parents or know people that live quite comfortably off the age pension. The other thing too is the age pension has definitely improved a bit as well. So it is more at that modest level now, which I think is different as well. So I don't see that there's... the only research that I've seen lately has really started to be the ASFA standard, which is starting to look at the different ages. In terms of sequence of returns risk, I would say just the awareness of that is fairly recent in a way. And I guess it's because two things. A, people have now been in drawdown accounts for a little while, and B, we have the GFC. So it's sort of highlighted, I guess, that particular risk, which I don't think was really... 5 years ago, I don't think you would have heard anyone talking about the sequence of returns risk. And I don't really know what the easy solution is. I think what you're suggesting is what some
probably advisors are more looking at, say, take a few years and put it in cash and leave the other invested. And that's just making a sort of pretty active decision about short-term needs, long-term needs. And the typical thing about investment strategy would reflect your time horizon. I think people have got in mind that it is something that, you know, we could do with some more product about, but it's hard to come up with that product because of the fact that soft guarantees, hard guarantees, hard guarantees cost. Do you end up back at cash anyway? So I think it's just one of the things that people are starting to look at now and seeing that there's potentially an appetite for that type of thing. Now, other people will say, the moment the markets get back, you know, and start delivering double digits, that appetite dries up in an instant. Maybe the markets won't get back to double digit. Mm.
Barry Rafe, just a couple of observations really. One is the 80% of people who will remain on the age pension. The risk there is it does create a false sense of security that that's actually what's going to happen. And if you look at, you know, given the intergenerational equity questions and the fact there's going to be this bubble of people going through, I'm not sure if our great-grandkids can afford to pay that. So there could be pressure on that, and there certainly has been examples now around the world where that's happened. The second thing is that I too am a supporter of the deferred age pension, certainly finding a way of back-ending, because it has all the right incentives to it. But the problem that Treasury has with that sort of thing is that there's a significant risk that they'll be selected against. And I think, as Pauline said in the session today, which I thought was staggering, was that life expectancy of people in Edinburgh is 20 years lower than in London. I mean, I just couldn't kind of get my head around what that means. But the sort of people that would be deferring would be the wealthy people. And they'll then be selecting against the government. And unless you actually can make it so that it's basically, you know, the conversion rate on the face of it looks actually quite bad. Only the wealthy people do it, and then what happens then is you get the, you know, they live longer than expected, and the poor people are subsidising the wealthy people and their higher age, deferred age pensions. So that's the issue that Treasury's got with that. I'm just trying to find a way of getting around it.
Okay, so two things. The percentage on the age pension, if you look at the intergenerational reports and the budgets, the age pension costs go, I think, from 2.6% gross domestic product to about 4%, but they're nowhere near a problem. They're not considered to be... Age pension in its own is not considered to be a problem for the country, even out 40 years. It's health costs. It's superimposed medical inflation health costs. So it's actually quite an affordable pension, even going out 40 years. In terms of the deferred age pension, you don't have the wealthiest group getting an entitlement anyway, so but you are still 80% of the population, but you don't have 20% because you can only defer what you inherently have an entitlement for anyway. The other thing is to say that you can, I mean, UK, there are in many countries that have a deferred age pension, they typically use something like about a 6% increase factor. You can still have quite a good increase factor, which I think would still be attractive and financially neutral. You do have the thing that when people defer it, they can defer it both to work and use their savings. So you are getting tax revenues, and I think that's the key, is that we've got to remember here that one of the things, one of our all-time ultimate goals is to keep people working for longer, because that's the primary solution to an ageing population. So I think if we factor in that, if we also factor in saying, well, they do cover that long end risk anyway, you know, even if we somehow put it onto annuities, if we have great systemic improvements in longevity, the government's going to be picking up the tab. You know, insurance companies may fail if we had masses of annuities and they didn't cope with a massive increase in longevity. So the government will never fully transfer that risk anyway. They will keep it. And I think it's a case of saying, look, it provides all the right incentives for what we want to do. We want people to work longer. We want them to self-support for longer, using their savings, using work, and has all that right incentives. And then we can look at, well, what is a reasonable increase factor to mitigate the risk to the government of doing it? And it creates a lot of opportunity for product in a known space of time, 5, 10, 15, 20 years.
Okay, so we're just about for lunch. One more comment question.
Tony Boffinger from Challenger. So I guess a comment and then a question for clarity. The comment is around, I guess, the protection scheme, but also your comment that, you know, ultimately the government is the insurer of last resort through the age pension. I guess if I'm the government, even if I have a protection scheme or I am the insurer of last resort in case life insurers fail, I would rather have a few tens of billions of shareholder capital standing in the way of that risk rather than just run the risk myself. On the clarity question, I guess, coming from your response to Barry's question about rich people deferring the age pension, are you suggesting, when you said they will only ever get what they were entitled to, so you're suggesting that the asset and income test would be carried out once only at retirement and that determines what you can defer, or is it still an ongoing test?
It's an ongoing test. I mean, I do think, and we've talked about it before, I do think you can simplify the assets income test, but accepting there will be a means test. It's not a one-off test because that's too risky, I think. It's an ongoing test. Like every year you've got an entitlement to an age pension based on the means test. You can choose to defer or take. Next year the same. So it is an ongoing test. So you don't get anything more than what you would have got if you'd chosen to take it at the time.
Okay, so we do have lunch now. So let's thank the speakers once more. Very, very interesting session.